From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, just a working actress. Catherine Keener doesn't think of herself as a star, but she's had plenty of memorable roles. She played a self-assured seductress in Being John Malkovich. In Capote, she played writer Harper Lee. And in The 40-Year-Old Virgin, she was the girlfriend who helped Steve Carell lose his virginity. Now she's co-starring in a new film, Friends with Money. Also, British actress Helen Mirren is best known for her role in the Prime Suspect series as Jane Tennyson, a police detective who has to prove her mettle as head of an all-male squad. Now she's playing a temperamental Queen Elizabeth I in a new HBO miniseries. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Actress Catherine Keener got her second Academy Award nomination earlier this year for her portrayal of Harper Lee in Capote, a performance which showcased the talent film buffs have been talking about for a long time. As our critic-at-large John Powers recently put it, over 15 years, Catherine Keener has built up a reservoir of affection from those who go to the movies regularly. She's sharp, vivid, and emotionally real. All her characters have filigrees and edges. Among Keener's many films are Being John Malkovich, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, The Interpreter, and two films by director Nicole Holofcener, Walking and Talking and Lovely and Amazing. Keener's latest film, Friends with Money, is also written and directed by Holofcener. Her co-stars include Frances McDormand, Joan Cusack, and Jennifer Aniston. It's about four women, all longtime friends, whose relationships are affected by differences in their financial standing. Keener's character is part of a husband and wife screenwriting team. In this scene, she argues with her husband about a script they're working on.
I have a problem with this line. I really think Elliot would believe her.
Why would he believe her? He saw his father yesterday.
Because it's... Melanie just doesn't joke like that. It's not in her character.
No, I don't agree.
God, how did we even get this far? It's like we're writing two different scripts.
Every time we disagree, you fall apart.
Oh, God.
You reading a lot of shit lately?
What?
I said you're eating a lot of shit lately.
So what?
So I can see it on your ass. I'm just telling you because, you know, thought you want me to tell you if I notice something like that.
What made you think I'd want you to tell me if my ass was getting fat?
Because I guess I would want you to tell me if I was gaining weight.
Really? You'd want me to tell you?
Yes, I would.
Would you want me to tell you, for instance, that you always have bed breath? Would you want to know that?
I guess.
Well, now you know. You know how I'm always trying to get you to drink more water? It's not because it's healthier. It's because your breath smells like a dead man.
Why didn't you just tell me? I would have got my teeth cleaned or something.
Because I didn't want to hurt your feelings.
It wouldn't.
Really?
Well, it's not like it's my fault, per se.
Man, I wish I had that mechanism.
So, not only do I have bad breath always, but I'm a dick because I don't take it personally.
I can't work anymore. I'm out.
Well, Catherine Keener, welcome back to Fresh Air. In Friends with Money, you play a woman who's part of a husband-wife screenwriting team. And by the time we meet you and your husband, played by Jason Isaacs, you're already arguing a lot. You're having a lot of trouble. And I'm wondering, you know, we don't learn in the scenes that we see how your character, mm-hmm. Christine, married this jerk. And kind of, you know, the backfill to a relationship that's clearly gone bad. And I'm wondering, as an actress, do you kind of feel like you need to fill in those edges to give the performance? I mean, how do you do that?
Well, with this, I didn't because I kind of, I mean— Nicole said that it was, they're done, you know, that it doesn't matter, it's irrelevant. Sort of like when a marriage does come to an end, it's kind of irrelevant what happened and who did what. So I just, my impulse definitely is to say, well, why and how did she, you know, but that's just sort of the questions that you ask from an outsider. But from her perspective, you know, she just buried herself so much in trying to fix everything externally and materialistically that it didn't really matter. It was pretty much gone. And he's not, I don't think that he's such a jerk. I think he's just done with her and her, you know, her ways. I mean, she's pretty self-absorbed and stuff. I kind of don't blame him in a way too. The kindness was gone. If it was ever there, it no longer exists between them. And some people should just, you know, not be married anymore.
You know, one theme of this film is how money changes relationships. You have one couple who's very rich and others who are, you know, different circumstances in life. And it occurred to me that I assume you probably have a lot more money than you did 10 or 15 years ago as your career has really taken off. Has that changed your relationships with old friends? Is that something that occurred to you as you made this film?
No, I haven't been that. I have more money, definitely, than I've had, especially growing up. I was, you know, pretty poor. But I don't have that, comparatively, I don't have that much money. I mean, I make little movies that are great and so fun to do, but you know, they're not the big paychecky movies that people make. So I think maybe if I were living high on the hog, maybe that would have had some sort of impact on my friendships. But my friends I have old friends, and you know, they're just they're friendships that have stuck, and I can't imagine them changing for any reason.
Your most recent Oscar nomination was for your role in Capote, where you played Harper Lee, the accomplished author of To Kill a Mockingbird, who is sort of Truman Capote's sidekick. And I thought we might hear a clip from that. And this is the scene very early in the film where you and Truman Capote are riding a train from New York out to Kansas to investigate this murder. And a porter has just brought your bags and says something to Truman Capote. So let's listen to this.
Thank you greatly, sir.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's an honor to have you with us, sir, and hope you won't mind me saying, but I thought your last book was even better than the first.
Thank you.
Yeah, and just when you think they've gotten as good as they can get.
Thank you very much.
Ma'am.
You're pathetic.
What?
You paid him to say that. You paid him to say that.
How did you know?
Just when you think they've gotten as good as they can get.
I thought that was a good line. Do you think that was too much?
A little bit.
My guest, Catherine Keener, with Philip Seymour Hoffman in the new film Capote. You know, what's fun about that scene is that you have Capote here paying a porter to impress one of his oldest friends. You know,
that's pathetic.
Yeah, right. That film, you are playing Harper Lee, who is the childhood friend of Truman Capote, who's played by Philip Seymour Hoffman. And so much of your role is being around him, reacting to him, because he has this huge, huge, oversized ego. Did you do anything with Philip Seymour Hoffman to develop the kind of relationship that worked on the screen?
Well, I hadn't met Phil until I got there. I was sort of the latecomer to the party because everybody else was sort of in place, and they were looking for a Harper. But it was very quick that it all kind of, I had to go to Winnipeg and start rehearsals. So I was a little kind of out of my water at first. I just thought, oh gosh, these guys have been sitting with this, and you know, it's going to be a good movie. You could just tell everybody was so committed and smart. So, and we did a couple of days or one day of rehearsal, and then I went to the train station there in Winnipeg, and then I went and bought two tickets for the next day to coach tickets for a train ride out. The first stop was about an hour and a half outside of Winnipeg, and so I asked Philip if he wanted to do this, and he said, sure. You know, we really didn't know each other at all, but we ended up getting on the train, and it was a really long train with a lot of classes, you know.
Right.
And they kept sort of, and I don't know if you see Phil, but he's got pretty much, especially when he's working, he's pretty much a uniform of sloppiness. And so and no one recognized him. You know, he's just in it, in working mode, and he's just, you know, already pretty dark. And we just we kept getting shuttled and seen to, you know. They kept sort of passing us off from class to class to make sure that we got into our safely ensconced seats of, like, general seating way in the back last train.
You mean you were being downgraded, put in your place, so to speak.
Yes. Right. So we were like, we were in our place. So, but it was funny because we actually kind of, our characters sort of, we started mimicking our characters, which often happens on movies. You see, all of a sudden you're adopting the same kind of behavior that your character would. And we sat up in the observation car, you know, and just watched the sunset. And, you know, it was sort of breaking the ice. I mean, I don't know. I was nervous.
Well, you've played so many movies that that are modern. You know, you're a modern woman, a kind of self-sufficient, educated person. Here you are set in the 50s where everybody has women wear perms and everybody smokes everywhere. Was it fun to inhabit that world?
Yeah, I never really thought of it in terms of I wasn't conscious of it being, you know, in the past. I wasn't aware of trying to do that. But it was more like people I know, like my dad's from North Carolina, from the mountains, and his sisters, they were sort of the people I was thinking about while I was working on that movie, because they're just, they're lovely and of a certain time and place and, you know, storytellers, but very good listeners and very, you know, they see to their guests, and it's just the way they are. No, that was what I was more conscious of. It was trying to just do these people justice, who I care a lot about and stuff.
In Capote, you're playing Harper Lee. I'm wondering how you did you research her life? Did you try and meet her?
I did research as much as I could. There wasn't a lot there, and I didn't try and meet her. I never got to that. I thought about it, and then I asked, you know, oh, can I just, maybe I'll just go to Alabama and, you know, see if she'll just have some coffee with me or something. And everyone told me that she's super private and that would not be a good idea. Mm-hmm. So I just, and that kind of, that was a little daunting because I thought, oh, God. I mean, not that I expected her to do that, but that just made me feel that, oh, maybe she wouldn't want this kind of, you know, look at her. And then I never want to, you know, I never want to do that to anybody. I'm not into prying when someone doesn't want you to, you know. So
yeah, I mean, it's very clear that that respecting privacy is a high value for you.
Right.
Did it feel weird to be playing by somebody who's still alive? Did you think about it?
It did, only in terms of just, I didn't want to disrespect her, you know, and her choice that she's made in her life, which is to lead a private one. And all of a sudden I was party to, you know, the contrary. Secondly, I didn't really know what she was like. There's not a lot of available material for that. So I just thought, oh, God, I hope I don't. You know, I wasn't trying to get it right. I just wanted to get it so it wasn't wrong, you know.
My guest is actress Catherine Keener. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with actress Catherine Keener. Her new film is Friends with Money. A lot more people got to see you than in some of your films when you starred with Steve Carell in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. And I thought maybe we'd play a little clip from that. This is your second date with Steve Carell, who, as the title suggests, has no experience with women. And we'll just to set up the scene, we can note that you and your first encounter, you were about to get physical, but before Carell's inexperience in the bedroom was revealed, your teenage daughter interrupted and ended the whole thing. Now you're getting together for a second time and getting to know each other.
Listen, Andy, I don't want to send you running for the hills or anything, but I really feel like if we decide to do this again, then maybe we should hold off on the physical part for a while.
That is a fantastic idea. Why didn't I think of that?
Really?
Totally.
No sex?
No. Why do that? Because here's the thing. From personal experience, I found that sex can really complicate things. And what we should be doing right now is just getting to know each other.
Yeah. Well, I never thought you'd go for it.
I'm going for it. Well, that just is a great, great notion.
Are you serious?
Look at my face. Look at how serious I am. You see my nostrils?
Yes.
That's serious. Both more angry.
Yeah, you know what? Most guys would be saying, yeah, right now. But, like, by the third date, it'd be, hey, baby, I really need to physically express how I feel
well,
and all that stuff.
Hey, baby. Yeah. You know, 3 dates? Make it 10. 10 dates.
How about 15?
15. 20 dates.
Okay, 20 dates.
20 dates.
Okay.
This is genius.
It's going to hurt.
And that's my guest, Catherine Keener, appearing with Steve Carell in The 40-Year-Old Virgin. Is it funny to hear that scene again?
Yes. I don't often sit here laughing at something I'm a part of, but he is so, yeah, that was a blast. That was really so fun to do. So he's really? Just wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, different from a lot of these independent films you've done. Was there a lot of improvising on the set with I mean, that wacky crew of guys that he works with at the electronics store?
Yeah, well, that crew of guys they're actually friends of Judd Apatow's, the director and co-writer. He and Steve wrote the movie. And it was part of what was so exciting to me that he was just making this movie with all his friends, and it was based on an idea that Steve had. So, and then when I talked to the director before we started, he said, you know, there's going to be a lot of improvising. And I thought, oh, God, you know, I'm used to doing movies where I just have so much respect for the writer that I'm not a writer, so I don't want to be expected to come up with some alternate lines. But with them, I mean, it was just, you kind of wanted to jump in. It was like, okay, let me try. And I've said that the director wouldn't yell cut. They would just reload the film because we just kept going and going and going. But it was such a different experience for me. I learned a lot on that movie about, I got a lot more confident about improvising, which I hadn't, because those guys are like top drawer.
Yeah, it seems like you're somebody who likes to laugh a lot. I mean, in some ways, you really fit here.
I do like to laugh. I think people just get, probably... Sometimes I go on these talk shows or like the Jon Stewart show I went on, and it was basically 5 minutes of me laughing. In fact, a friend of mine did an interview of me in Interview Magazine. My friend Sarah Vowell, I don't know if you know her, but she's incredible.
Yeah, she appears on public radio a lot.
Yeah, well, so Sarah said that her one stipulation with Interview Magazine was that they wouldn't parenthetically write, and she laughs, you know, because it would take up the whole interview. But I can't help it. I think people are funny.
You've been described in... it was interesting to me as I read a lot of pieces about you and the descriptions of you and your work. Here are some of the things said about you and kind of your persona. You're described as the coolest mom in the playgroup, instantly familiar, the woman at work you wish you knew, brilliantly, gorgeously mundane, capable of grinding a man to sawdust. And then one described your roles as a spectrum of sexy, neurotic, bitchy, needy, goofy, and sweet. It's somebody who just doesn't have a mold. And that must be a nice thing for an actress, right?
Yeah, I think it's a nice thing. I'm not, I think that nobody wants a mold. I mean, a mold is just something I think that it's, you know, that you don't invent, other people do. But, God, grinding a man. I could grind my teeth to bits, but not.
Well, I think that character in being John Malkovich ground John Cusack to sawdust more than once.
yeah, but come on, he deserved it.
He was asking for it, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. No, I mean, I do appreciate, I'm glad that is a perception, you know. I'd rather that than somebody who's, you know, can't work outside that box that that they're put in or they put themselves in.
Now, I read once that you described yourself as not movie star material. You said you were your co-star material, and those are the roles that you like. Do you still feel that way now that you've gotten 2 Oscar nominations and, you know, are well known on the red carpet and all?
I'm well known on the red carpet.
Well, yeah. I think people know who Catherine Keener is when she shows up, don't you?
You should be with me when I've followed, at the Oscars. I came in, I was right behind, Charlize or Theron or right in front of her when I was invisible. And that was the best because I could just bolt right through. So I would say I'm moderately known on the red carpet. But I think that's kind of what I meant, is like some people are really movie stars and they're great at it and they don't mind it. They kind of understand that that's part of what their place is. I'm not that person. I'm not comfortable that way. I'm not perceived that way. I mean, I'm just sort of a working actor who's doing pretty well. And I think the 40-year-old virgin definitely sort of broadened my public, you know, visibility or whatever a little bit. But it goes away, you know. You just kind of just go back to your life and lay low for a little while. Then that wanes and somebody else will come along who can deal with it better.
Well, Catherine Keener, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
Catherine Keener. Her new film is Friends with Money. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Understanding the Crucial Link Between Mothers, Daughters, and Health, by Dr. Christiane Northrup. From Capella University, an accredited university online with degrees in business, IT, education, human services, and psychology, capella.edu. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. Information at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Temperamental queen, a police detective trying to earn the respect of her all-male squad, a wealthy man's murderous housekeeper, and the adulterous wife of a sadistic restaurant owner. These are some of the roles of British actress Helen Mirren. Coming up, we talk with Helen Mirren. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. In her latest role, my guest, English actress Helen Mirren, is Queen Elizabeth I.
Well, gentlemen, I've come to hear you talk, and I trust you will watch me while I listen.
Your Majesty, we beg to raise the question of your marriage.
Well, so long as you do not come to me to complain about your wives, I am content.
Helen Mirren became widely known to American television audiences 15 years ago when she played Detective Jane Tennyson in the first Prime Suspect mystery series. She has a long list of stage, screen, and television credits and earned Oscar nominations for Best Supporting Actress for her performances in The Madness of King George and Gosford Park. Among her other films are The Comfort of Strangers, The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, and Her Lover, The Mosquito Coast, White Nights, and Excalibur. The two-part miniseries Elizabeth I debuts Saturday on HBO. The film chronicles the 16th century monarch's battles with Spain and her mortal conflict with her cousin Mary, Queen of Scots, but it also deals with Elizabeth's turbulent emotional life, including her relationship with the Earl of Leicester, played by Jeremy Irons. Well, Helen Mirren, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're playing Queen Elizabeth I in this new production. Now, of course, some great actresses have played this monarch: Betty Davis, Glinda Jackson, Judi Dench, Cate Blanchett. Did you look at their performances, or is that something maybe you wanted to avoid?
No, you know, it's not relevant, really. You know, your work is to find what you think this person is. And also, you know, it all begins with the writing. And it all depends what the vehicle is within which this Elizabeth lives, you know. So it's not remotely helpful to watch somebody else's work because it's in a different vehicle, it's different writing. You know, there are different, all kinds of different issues at play.
Can you think of anything in the reading that you did about Elizabeth that you thought gave you some, you know, emotional insight into this woman?
I think one thing in particular really affected me was reading that at one point she was so angry she actually passed out.
Really?
Yes. And I thought, wow, that's like really angry. I can't imagine being so angry that you literally pass out. And then, you know, you really got the, I got the impression of an incredibly tempestuous emotional woman, where she was unafraid of her own emotions. She had no reason to be afraid of them. She could let them loose because she was a queen. She could do anything. She could cry, she could scream, she could throw shoes, she could shut herself away, she could, you know, really play up, you know, as far as she wanted to without any kind of censure, really.
Well, I thought we should listen to a clip from Queen Elizabeth I, in which you play the monarch. And the one I thought we would hear is where you, as Queen Elizabeth, learned that the Earl of Leicester, whom the Queen has had a long-running affair or flirtation with, she's learned that he is actually secretly married. He is played here by Jeremy Irons. And, of course, my guest, Helen Mirren, Elizabeth I. Let's hear her discover that her friend is actually married.
Oh, you son of a whore.
Your Majesty, you must know that...
Know what, my lord?
That I would never have taken a wife. If there were but a chance, you would smile upon my suit.
I never wish to see your face again.
My heart still runs on you, I swear it.
Be off before I hang you. I'm minded to hang you now with my own hands.
Bess.
Get out of my sight! We forbid you access to our presence. You are no longer welcome at our court. Be gone, sir. Now.
And that's our guest Helen Mirren portraying Queen Elizabeth I in a new production that will be debuting on HBO. Jeremy Irons is there also in that scene as the Earl of Leicester. You know, what's interesting about listening to that scene is that we hear the Queen, when she loses control, actually use the word I in public, refer to herself in the first person singular, and then she realizes it, composes herself, and begins speaking in the royal we. You are no longer yes. welcome in our presence. Did you sort of have to become comfortable with a public and a private Elizabeth in developing this character?
Yes. I mean, that's very much what our piece is about, is the public versus and intertwined with the private. I mean, obviously that was, you know, what we were playing with all the time. It's very difficult to go behind the velvet curtains or the heavy oak doors of history, you know, and find out what that person was actually like in private, because obviously so much of what we read is very much either through contemporary writing that's flattering, highly flattering. No one quite, you know, certainly you wouldn't dare criticize the Queen. The most truthful writings that I ever read about her, you always came from ambassadors, foreign ambassadors who were sent to the British English court and then wrote back to their kings or queens or whoever had sent them. And then they would actually tell the truth because they were not in fear of censorship, you know. So those were the most sort of accurate descriptions of Elizabeth.
You know, one of the things about doing it, portraying a 16th century queen is you wear a lot of stuff.
I mean, stuff, yes.
Stuff in your hair.
Couldn't be enough for me, I tell you.
Yeah, you like that.
I loved
that, huh?
All of that. Oh, I loved it. Yes, it's great.
Well, I read that. Did you also wear contact lenses to tint your eyes?
Yes, I did. I noticed when I looked at all the portraits that her eyes were always very black, very dark. And although it was very fashionable to have white skin, the only descriptions that I could find of her that were maybe truthful actually described her as having rather sallow skin. So she wasn't this white-skinned, red, you know, rosy-cheeked person at all. She was, her red hair was natural. And then one of the ambassadors described her as having black eyes. And I thought this black-eyed look, which is very piercing, it's quite intimidating. If you know anyone with very dark, dark brown eyes, you know, it's quite a piercing, intimidating look it gives to their eyes. I thought that would be quite a good tool. So I thought he's probably historically accurate. So yes, I wore dark brown lenses.
Now, of course, it's interesting that in addition to this portrayal of Elizabeth I, you have just finished a production in which you play Elizabeth II, right, the current queen. Is that right?
Yes, I do. Absolutely.
How would you compare the two? Is there any connection?
There's a big connection, you know. It was very interesting. Such completely different personalities. You couldn't get more extreme differences in personality. The Elizabeth I, very not governed by her emotions, far from it. She was governed by her sense of power and her sense of autocracy, but a much more emotional person. And this present queen, who's governed by an overriding sense of self-discipline, duty, and sacrifice. But the thing that they absolutely have in common is this single-minded dedication and desire to be who they are. And I think they share that absolutely. And it's what makes both of them, I think, very mighty monarchs. And I think Elizabeth II will, as history travels on, will be looked back on as a very, very iconic and important figure in British history.
We're speaking with actress Helen Mirren. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is actress Helen Mirren. She portrays Queen Elizabeth I in an HBO movie, which will premiere on the 22nd. Now, you went into films in your 20s, late 20s. And then in the 70s, I read you sort of took a hiatus from a traditional acting course and joined Peter Brook's Experimental International Center of Theater Research, which involved, touring Africa and parts of the United States, performing in very small settings, California farm workers.
It says Chavez, in fact.
Right. What appealed to you about that?
It worked.
And then what did you get from that experience?
Well, you know, it was a part of my sort of my search, my holy grail, to try and be better. And having done a lot of Shakespeare in that formal theatre environment, I felt it was time to throw everything up in the air. And I was lucky enough to be around when Brooke was just beginning that particular period of his life's work. And I joined for 1 year. So, yes, we travelled through Africa We started in Algeria and went down to Nigeria, south of Nigeria, and then back up again, travelling in jeeps and working in just very, very small villages, never in any towns. And then we came to America and we worked with the Teatro Campesino and with other theatre groups in America.
Was this for you more a matter of developing your acting craft, and or was it a matter of personal or political growth?
Not political. So it was apolitical. I mean, I think it was personal. Yes, personal acting growth. Not personal growth as a person. Although, of course, it turned into a bit of that as well, because when you're challenged like that, and it was very, very challenging, difficult work, you are, you know, you do have to make some sort of personal growth, which I'm still in the process of learning from that experience now. But it was very much to discover other ways of acting. I don't know whether that I really actually learned anything in reality, except for conquering fear, maybe.
Well, and you got a tattoo out of it.
I did, in America. But, you know, when I got tattooed, I can't believe it's become fashionable. When I got tattooed, it's only Hell's Angels and gay sailors who were tattooed, you know. And it was actually then, it was very cool to have a tattoo because, you know, it gave you an instant in with very, you know, I was never afraid of walking down dark streets at night because anyone who was likely to attack me was probably likely to have a tattoo. And there's nothing people like better than to talk about their tattoos.
We're speaking with actress Helen Mirren. She plays Queen Elizabeth I in an HBO movie that will premiere soon. It is called Elizabeth I. I wanted to talk about another film for which you received a Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actress. That's Gosford Park, a film I don't know well because I've only seen it twice. It's wonderfully complex.
You've only seen it twice.
Yes, I've only seen it twice.
I know what you mean about that's the nature of Altman's movies, isn't it? Yes.
Right. There's so much happening that never quite get it all. I mean, this is one in which there's a weekend party in a British estate in the 1930s. And the wonderful thing is that we see the world of the affluent, the middle-class people, and then also below stairs, their servants, which you occupy in this case. And I wanted to thought we would listen to a clip from the film. This is just to explain what's happening here. In this, you play the housekeeper of a wealthy man, Lord William Stockbridge, who hosts this party and is actually murdered in the course of it. And it turns out that when your character, Mrs. Wilson, was a young girl, she was one of many servants whom Stockbridge had sexually preyed upon. She bore a son which had been sent away to an orphanage, but which now many years later turns out returns to the estate as a valet of one of the guests. He recognizes his father and decides he's going to kill this man who had abandoned him. But your character, Mrs. Wilson, sees this coming and instead poisons Stockbridge first, so her son, in fact, can't be accused of killing him. And the scene we're going to play here is a memorable one in which you are discussing this with another servant, played by Kelly MacDonald. Let's listen.
But even if Robert is your son, how did you know that he meant to harm his father?
What gift do you think a good servant has that separates them from the others? It's the gift of anticipation. And I'm a good servant. I'm better than good. I'm the best. I'm the perfect servant. I know when they'll be hungry and the food is ready. I know when they'll be tired and the bed is turned down. I know it before they know it themselves.
Are you going to tell them?
Why? What purpose would it possibly serve?
What if they find out what happened?
Not much of a crime to stab a dead man, is it? They can never touch him. That's what's important, his life.
And your life?
Didn't you hear me? I'm the perfect servant. I have no life.
And that's our guest, Helen Mirren, in the film Gosford Park. She's speaking there with Kelly MacDonald. A wonderful scene. I wonder if you could tell us a little about making that.
Yeah, it's a lovely piece of writing, isn't
it? Well, that's what's interesting, I think. You know, a lot of actors love to be with Altman because, I mean, his reputation is that of a lot of improvising and free-flowing. I mean, this is, you've come from, you know, performing a lot of Shakespeare. What was it like to work with Altman
Well, it's a bit of a misnomer, really, that, you know, Altman is all about improvisation. That's not actually true. He choreographs very precisely. You know, he loves the text, and the text is important. But what he does do is he has everybody mic'd all the time. And so as important as the visual story is the sound story in an Altman movie. And because you're mic'd, everything you say, and sometimes you do improvise it, all actors do, you know, those little moments of improvisation can be used. And then, of course, the way he shoots is very extraordinary, and it creates this improvisational look to the movie. But in reality, it's very, very carefully choreographed and very precise, in fact. That was my experience, anyway.
Yeah. What do you mean by the way he shoots, creating that feel?
Well, I mean, it's a sort of technical thing, but for example, he very often shoots with two cameras, and the two cameras are often moving simultaneously, which is sort of unheard of on you know, when you're shooting a movie. And you'll never know if you're in close-up or if you're in a wide shot or if it's a mid-shot while you're playing the scene. You don't know what kind of shot you're in. So you can't become conscious in that particular way. It's a particular kind of technique. That's very visually, it creates a sort of rather extraordinary thing, and also for the actors, you play it almost like a play. You play the whole scene through, not quite knowing when you're on camera, if you're off camera, if you're in close up. So it's very individual, and I loved the way he worked. I thought it was amazing.
When you saw the final product, was it what you expected it to be?
It was more than I expected it to be. I thought it was fantastic. It had because of his way of shooting, it gives the story an inner life somehow, and a sort of and that sense of naturalism that you're talking about. I thought it was great. I loved it, and I loved the fact that he was very, very keen that all the details of that sort of a household were correct, you know, that the way the spoons were kept and the way the pantry looked and all of those technical details, visual details, had to be absolutely right. And we had on set with us all the time, we had a very old man and an old woman who had worked in that sort of a household as advisors to tell us what people would do and wouldn't do.
We're speaking with actress Helen Mirren. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actress Helen Mirren. She stars in a new HBO miniseries, Elizabeth I. Well, Helen Mirren, you're in 1991. You had a role with which you've become much identified when you played Jane Tennyson in the Prime Suspect series. I thought we'd hear a little bit of the first Prime Suspect series, and this one is one in which you have been a district chief inspector. That's the rank where you should be able to handle a murder investigation, but the men in the department have found ways not to let you actually get an investigation to cover. And in this case, one person who has begun a major investigation, one of the officers has died, and you've come in to assert your right to get involved in this major police work.
This may not be the right time, sir, but under the circumstances, I'm not quite sure when would be the right time. I'm offering to take over the murder investigation.
I don't have to tell you that I am qualified to handle this investigation and that I have been waiting for... Well, I don't have to tell you how long. 18 months. And in that time, I've had to handle more paperwork than I did at Reading for my whole 5 years dealing with sex cases. I know DCI Shefford was at a crucial stage of the investigation.
I have to see his wife this afternoon. Don't expect me to make any decisions now. This is not the right time.
Well, when is the right time? Look, I am the only officer of my rank who has continually overstepped, sidestepped, whatever. Just give me the chance to prove that I can
You don't have to prove yourself to me. Let me think about it.
Well, that's not enough, Michael. I'm getting sick to death of this so-called Metropolitan Police survey being thrown at me. So, all right, apparently 90% of the time the general public would prefer a male officer. But until one of us gets a chance to prove that that survey is a biased, outdated load of
old... A man who I respected highly died right there. And now, Inspector, is not the time to thrust your women's rights down my throat. I'll get back to you.
Thank you, sir.
That was my guest Helen Mirren playing Jane Tennyson in the original Prime Suspect series. Acting in that scene with her was John Benfield. You know, a lot of the fans of that series, me included, could hardly imagine anybody but you in that role. Did it seem like a perfect fit when you read it?
I don't know about that. I mean, I did recognize that I was jolly lucky to have it, you know, because it's so rare, even to this day, incidentally, that a woman drives the narrative of a drama. You can have very good female roles and things, but rarely are they actually driving the narrative. And then it was even less likely, especially on television or anywhere. You know, that was what fascinated me, the fact that it was a female character driving the narrative. The fact that it was a police thing and Jane Tennyson and all the rest of it didn't really impinge upon my consciousness. I just saw that it was a, you know, really a lovely, complex role.
Did you learn any gestures or vocal mechanisms that you put into that character, do you recall?
The only thing was that I, you know, a policewoman who was quite high up, said she never folds her arms. I thought that was a very interesting. You know, police are very, very into body language. They can read you like a book. The good detectives, they understand body language extremely well. It's how they do their job a lot of the time, and she said, don't fold your arms. Because folding your arms is, it looks, you think you're being strong. And I laugh now. I often see, you know, there's big posters of women playing police women, and they've always standing there with their arms folded, thinking, oh, this looks powerful and strong. Not, you know, folding your arms is a defensive action, and much more powerful is to stand with your arms relaxed by your side, open, you know, ready.
There have been six, I believe. Is there going to be a seventh?
I'm in the process of doing the last one right now. The last one. I think it's seven. I've lost count. Yeah.
This would be the seventh. Why the last one?
Because I think it's time to stop. I did stop for 7 years, actually. I said no. It was time to not do it for a while, anyway. I felt I was maybe in certain people's minds a little too identified with it. I felt that if I was knocked over, you know, the headline would read, Jane Tennyson dies. so I thought I'd better, you know, try and extricate myself from that. And so I didn't do it for 7 years. And then I felt, you know, it is a wonderful role. And that the best thing about doing that is I get to work with really good writers, really good directors, and really good actors. I have the pick of the best in Britain. So, you know, you don't turn your back on that too easily. So I did one more thinking, well, if it was not successful, that's it, end of story. And it was hugely successful. It was really, really well received. So I thought I'd do one more, the last one, which is what I'm doing now.
Well, Helen Mirren, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
Actress Helen Mirren. She stars in a new HBO miniseries, Elizabeth I, which premieres Saturday. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. We'll end today's show with music from Thelonious Monk. He was just recognized with a special Pulitzer Prize Award for his compositions. This is his song, Hackensack.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art and its current exhibition of paintings by Edvard Munch. MOMA.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what DNA evidence is now telling us about early humans? We talk with New York Times reporter Nicholas Wade, author of Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.